When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
And welcome to episode 97 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. I hope you're all doing well out there and only a few days away till Christmas. Or, if you don't celebrate it, only a few days away to a relatively quiet weekend. It's not going to be quite what we wanted this year, but come on, we're all made of stronger stuff than this. We've been going through a really shit year and we can put aside 2 days out of our lifetime. And just use it as a big black line to draw under 2020 and look forward to 2021. It can't be much worse than 2020, right? But anyway, back to podcast world. Firstly, I'd like to give a big thank you to all our new Patreon supporters. Thank you, guys. What you're doing really does make a difference. And you can help support the podcast too for as little as £3, which is pretty much just a cup of coffee per month. We've been self-funded since day one, and it is making it quite difficult to grow. So if you can spare at least £3 a month, that really would be great. And if you can't, that's cool. Don't feel obliged. This week, I'm taking you to meet a street artist who I've wanted on the show since the very first moment I saw his work. I walked around a corner from Brick Lane, and bang, in front of me was an enormous, highly detailed, spray-painted portrait of an indigenous tribesman. And it's none other than Mr. Dal Grimshaw. The amazing thing about Dal's portraits, and we touch on it in the podcast, is although their scale is enormous, they don't come across as intimidating. They're sort of calming and almost friendly. But I won't try and explain too much about them myself because, well, Dal can do a far better job of that than I ever could. Reading just a little excerpt from Dal's biography. More recently, he has been devoting time to street murals and has been widely recognised as one of the most powerful and talented of street artists on the scene. Over the past 5 years, he has been invited to festivals nationally and internationally, as well as painting many iconic walls across London where he lives. Dal's work is boldly figurative and is inspired by his strongly held humanitarian beliefs. However, this political message is always achieved by an emphasis on powerful direct emotions and a deep empathy for his subjects. Dal continues to support the work of the Free West Papua campaign, which is opposed to the illegal occupation of West Papua in Indonesia. This is another podcast that was recorded over Zoom, using their own software, so the quality is not quite what you'd expect, but the content always is. And if we speak of a few references that seem a little bit out of date, this podcast was recorded quite a while ago. But anyway, come with me and meet Mr. Dal Grimshaw.
Dal, I've got seven questions that I ask each artist. The first being is, how would you explain what you do to someone that didn't know your work?
Oh, Christ. Well, I kind of do it drunkenly in social situations anyway. I'll give you the response rather than it's normally like, oh, that's interesting. And, oh, do you make money out of that? And are you Banksy? They're normally the crap responses I get. A white wine facial. Like, shut up. Yeah. I just describe myself as a painter, really, but because of my homemade tattoos and I'm normally a bit drunk, people presume I'm kind of more into the painting and decorating arena, which I have to correct them. So I love the word painter, but I often have to say artiste. I'm an artist. Yeah. So yeah, because it confuses people. They don't, you know, it throws them off. But yeah, I'm just a figurative painter, and people normally say, well, what do you mean a figurative painter? I say, well, I do oil paintings and spray paintings of human beings, and the whole work is based around kind of the human form and people and emotions, and then they just get even more confused.
Exactly.
Even more patronising. Yeah. Like, oh, that sounds so interesting. Yeah. Lovely to speak to you.
And do you think, your accent, do you think that throws them off a little bit?
Yeah, it does. People do make a lot of assumptions. I mean, we do it all the time, don't we?
Yeah, I
mean,
that.
Yeah, we all do it. And I think sometimes it borders on prejudice in a way, you know. It really does, the way we view other people, whether it's our accents, our skin colour, our hair and things. And it's sad that people do it, but I have had it all my life. And yeah. And I've done it to other people, and I've felt really ashamed at times when I've made assumptions about people and about their education of a job and things based on the way they look, because I don't really like it myself. So sometimes I'm fighting that battle, really. You know, when people ask me, I don't really know what people expect me to do, but they never expect me to say I'm an artist. I think it's the last thing. So that tends to throw people off a bit.
To be fair, I suppose all of our preconceived ideas are only through what we've experienced in life, isn't it?
And exactly,
you know, first impressions, you see, you know, a guy with a northern accent or a southern accent, a cockney accent, a Scouse accent, you sort of put them in your box, and then that box sort of widens as you speak to them, doesn't it?
Exactly. And as the wine goes down, hopefully it becomes a bit more of a colourful, friendlier, wider box. But yeah, it's a shame sometimes you do feel. I mean, it's nice when people know your work as well. I mean, I've had like people come to fix, like, you know, the utility, whether it's I can't remember the specifics, the boiler or the dishwasher. And they're kind of looking at paintings on the living room wall, which you can't see. It was actually a Guy Denning painting.
Yeah, I could see him.
You know, and they say, hey, mate, we used to paint, and we start chatting about art, and then they ask me what I do, and then I say, oh, paint. And I literally had one guy said, I've just driven past one of your murals in, like, I think it was in Camden. So it's really nice when you make that, because that's what I love about the street art, you know, it just cuts away all the nonsense.
Pulls down the barriers.
On a wet Thursday morning or a wet Friday afternoon in this case. You know, it shoots through all the bullshit. And I've literally had that. People went, oh, God, I think I had another time where somebody had checked up to about art, and then they had to come back, and in that interim period they went, oh, God, now you've mentioned it, I've been, you know. Excellent. So I was at college with somebody who was quite famous, and I didn't know a famous singer, and I didn't really get on with her. I thought she was a bit of a snooty cow. But I met this guy, and he said, oh, you know, Alison's doing really, really well now. And I said, well, I don't know who she is and things. And then once he mentioned the band name, I saw posters everywhere on the tubes. It was almost like it became part of, like, I entered another dimension. And I think that can sometimes happen. Once you mention it, people become very aware of, you know, the subject and ideas, and especially with my current work, because it's quite colourful and it's quite in your face. So it's nice when ordinary people kind of go, oh, God, I've seen that, mate. Yeah. So I was like, buy your print now, you bastard.
When was your first interest in art, Dal? Was there art at home?
Yeah, I'm not from an arty background. I mean, my gran sang, she was quite eccentric and kind of patronising types of colour eccentric. But my dad was a builder. There was nobody really directly interested in art. And I don't really know how I got into it, but I just, we had some, it's funny because on Facebook, I'm just going to post a photograph of me on location of a John Constable painting. And it's a famous one called The Hay Rain, and it was based maybe the borders of Cambridge. And I went, and that image is ingrained in my mind because, like, a lot of council houses and things had prints of Constable. There was The Hay Rain and The Cornfield. So I kind of, my introduction to a lot of painting was a lot of British painters like that. And so it's really amazing. The other week I was on holiday and I went to see it. But to answer your question, yeah, that was some of my earliest interest in art. But music record covers, you know, punk record covers. And there was, looking back, I didn't realise at the time, but there was a lot of really exciting stuff like woodcut prints and paintings, early Adam and the Ants, the kind of double exposure photography where everybody looked like they were doing that on a slow aperture. And so I was exposed to a lot of things, like creatively, and a lot of medieval history book illustrations, what I found really exciting as well, and that kind of, which fits in with the tribal thing. That, so it was that, and I would paint. I don't know, really, I just like making a mess, and I think I kind of gravitated towards paint, and I used to have to steal them. I became quite a good shoplifter because we didn't really have any money, and I didn't really understand about acrylic paint and oil paint.
Yeah,
it didn't really mean, if it looked nice on the tube, I put it in my school bag. But I was quite shy. I was a very smiley kid and probably quite effeminate and chatty. And I think it disarmed people. They said, oh, look at this sweet little boy. Well, they didn't realise I was this, like, chronic rampant shoplifter. But it gave me the opportunity to experiment. And, like, I mean, no kids from my background were painting in oil paints at kind of 11 years old. But it did. I know I will burn in hell for my crimes against, shop industry. But it did, to answer your question, it did allow me, it was a bit of a gateway into being able to experiment with paint and things. And like I said, I used to mix the acrylic paint and the oil paint up and kind of thing, which is happening a lot on the urban art scene now, the graffiti scene. Everybody's playing with everything and mixing old spray paint and old kind of layering things up. So I was ahead of my time, to be honest. But yeah, it just came through naivety. But and I would copy things out of books as well. I really liked a lot of good, like, still lives and, it was a weird hybrid of punk covers, medieval history books, and my mum's kind of prints of Constable on the wall, and then seeing punk graffiti as well, with Stranglers and The Damned and things, and as it's well documented, as I said before, you know, stuff, seeing like punk band names and things, or kind of Debbie is a Slut by Tina B and all that, and it was all just a melting pot of kind of creativity. And it just merged in. I don't know really how I ended up where I am. But
So was there not many people from your school that went on to doing a foundation? Or
I don't think so, no. I mean, there was a couple of guys who were kind of from, they were kind of better looking and better drawers and from nicer backgrounds. But I'd have to look them up on Facebook. I can't imagine they did. But I mean, for me, it was a lifeline. You know, it literally saved my life, did I?
Yeah.
I know when I say that to people, they kind of go, oh, what a cliche. But without going into grisly details, you know, I was quite unhappy as a teenager and kind of lucky still to be here, really, to be blunt about it. So I feel kind of, oh, it was one of those things that really, like, anchored me down when things were really bad. And, it could have ended quite badly for me. It was one of those things that always was like a relationship. It's like a family member that always kept an eye on me.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I feel, there's this kind of, it's just the only kind of solid, consistent thing that's gone through my life in a way.
And it can be like a heavy drug dealt art, can't it? Because it is a, it can make you escape from your situation.
Yeah, it can. It can also be stressful. Yeah. I mean, in those days, it wasn't stressful. I find it a bit more, you know, in the middle of, I don't know, doing a mural in the pouring rain and you're hungover or you feel ill and you've got a plane to catch and a couple of days, you know, it can be quite stressful. But in the early days, as you say, to reiterate, it was a form of escapism, and it's kind of lovely. But, and I know a lot of people have been doing art during lockdown, and I think it's been really good for people. Just, I hope they've been paying for their art materials, but I know I've been chatting to people. A lot of people have been really enjoying it, and it's caused a lot of, there has been a lot of problems with lockdown. I think it's taken the lid off a lot of our kind of mental health problems, for the use of a better term. And it's nice that people have been kind of self-medicating through art in a way. And it is a bit of a lifeline, and it has for me. But I didn't know when I started in the early days, when I was like 10, 9, 10, 11, I didn't realise how important it was going to be, and that it was actually going to be a lifesaver for me through my life. But does that answer your question?
It very much does. Well, I'm in the same boat as you, using that cliche often, because I don't know if you're aware, but I got into art in prison.
Like, oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, I was doing a 14-year prison sentence for drugs. And then I just fell into
art. Taking them or selling them?
Importing them.
Yeah, all right, okay.
And I just fell into art. It was nothing that I'd ever thought of. You know, I'd never been creative, or I'd always been creative, but I hadn't really created anything. You know, I had a creative mind, but I never put it into practice. Then I'd done an art class, fell in love with art, and I ended up writing to, like, you know, like Sarah Lucas, Tracy Emin.
Oh, Abby God, Turk. Yeah.
And they was all writing to me while I was in prison, you know?
Oh, like, brilliant.
And this was back in like 96 when they
that period where they were really big. Oh, blimey, I didn't realize that. So you've had a similar experience to me where, you know, you're in a tight situation, kind of creativity has come along and
it did give me a 180 degree turn to my life. And what I've always said, I mean, I've got, obviously biased, but I've got great children. They're loving, they're kind, they're nice kids.
Yeah,
they wouldn't have been like that before, because I wasn't like this before. I wasn't the person you're talking to now. I was one of those fug arseholes who, you know, I was always getting into tear-ups. I was a minder, a bouncer, a debt collector.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, all that sort of shit, you know. And you've done your foundation in Blackburn.
Yeah.
And then you've done your degree in University of Middlesex. How was that move? Or why was that move?
What, the jump geographically? Right. Well, I'd always wanted to come to London again. You know, it's well documented. I was fascinated with kind of the 70s punk scene and the stuff that I was seeing through Top of the Pops, and kind of, you know, the kind of punk scene or the post-punk or new romantic, that whole kind of late 70s, early 80s or mid-80s thing. So I was very aware of London anyway. It was like kind of, you know, it was like the destination for me, because a lot of what I was kind of listening to and reading about and things would talk about, you know, the King's Road or St. Martin's College of Art. So I was kind of quite aware of all these very famous kind of monumental art institutions or places or hangouts or music venues when I was quite young. So I don't know, but I did graphic design at first, because I thought, you know, I was a good old working class lad. I was like, I better do something very kind of
practical. Yeah, a trade, a job.
Yeah, it was like that bullshit. But I really wasn't really for me. I was quite messy and stuff, and I was always fucking things up. And, you know, you'd have to buy that those days, you know, you would do all the like the font by hand with like these watering pens. And oh, God, I'd always end up with like ink in my face or on my spikes. So it was everywhere. So I clearly wasn't really made for that pristine thing. And really the turning, I mean, I was still painting and things. I'd been drawing and painting, obviously, as I'd said. And I was doing quite a few punk jackets and things. And people would say, oh, you know, could you paint this or can you paint that? So there was a bit of a kind of a business, you know, the little small acorn of a business idea bird that I was kind of doing this kind of commercial stuff, but it was still giving me an opportunity to be quite paying to live. But it was only really the turning point was when my mum died. And I think I'd just finished graphic design. I was about 18, 17. And then mum died, and it really threw things off for me. And I think with hindsight, it's only recently, because I've gone into psychotherapy recently, and it's only till recently that I realised really it was not just about pursuing the art. I think I was just escaping. I really didn't know how to deal with it. I had nobody to talk to because being surrounded by northern teenagers like me, I mean, I just had to deal with this monumental grieving and this loss and this, you know, this trying to get some grasp of what had happened and to my mum. And I think I just fled in a way. I just thought, well, you know, London's the place to be. And I just kind of packed up because I was in care, you see, and I'd left care. And then within about a couple of years, a year and a half, mum had died. And it just totally flipped me, I think. But at the time, I had it in my head, I'd always decided I was going to leave. But I think it was just that really kind of aggressive, like, push that really shoved me out of Lancashire. And so I started applying for colleges and things. And I was like going to St. Martin's, and I had a day trip, you know. It was typical me. I spiked my hair. I went, got on the train at Blackburn. I think I had to change. And I went straight for the first class, and I put my feet on the seats. And this guy was, you know, he was making assumptions because I'm a 15-inch spiker. So he kicked me out of the first class. So I was like, fucking arsehole. So I got to London. I was looking around all the colleges, and there was all like St. Martin's and Chelsea. And they just seemed really stuck up. I just thought, Christ, you know, I can't really imagine me fitting in here, you know. And then I got the tube up to Wood Green in North London, and there was a lot. I was looking around Middlesex, and then there was some lass with kind of some crusty punk lass, like drinking special brews, you know, like the big fucked up dreadlocks, and she was like making some sculpture, and she sat on this chair drinking special brews, and I was like, this is the place for me. So it was a bit like that. I could just see there were all kinds of people, but I could just see it was the kind of place people, you could kind of get on with it and be yourself, and it wasn't too kind of precious, and I couldn't be doing with that. So it was kind of, and I was really pleased I got in and I got a place. So I was really chuffed with that. But I don't think I'd have lasted it.
When was it you realised you wanted to be an artist?
Well, when I was young, people would ask me when I was a kid what I want to be. And I'd say stupid, I didn't really know about artists. So I did this term, an art student. So I'd say things, I think my three main things were, one was an archaeologist, because I loved a lot of history and the idea of time and layering, and interested in the Dark Ages, the feudal period. So I'd either say an archaeologist, a serial killer, or an art student. There was something, because I was reading a lot, I was sneaking a lot of books about the occult and kind of serial killers and weird. I was quite a weird child. I'm lucky to be as normal as I am, really. And but then it dawned on me, be a serial killer. You what, sorry?
I said, I'll be the judge of that.
So yeah, I think it kind of oscillated between digging up Saxon helmets and painting on bus stops or painting on canvases. So, but yeah, I think I was a child that knew what I wanted to do. I knew that I was never really going to fit in with your everyday run of the mill. It was pretty obvious from a young age, and I'm quite proud of that now. But when I was younger, like I said, just living up north in Accrington, it felt. I know a lot of people say that like, you don't feel like you fit in and things, but it is a horrible feeling when on almost like every level of your life, you just don't feel sometimes you're communicating and fitting in. And it is a cliche, but now with hindsight, I'm kind of pleased there's a bit of punk rock about that. I just think, well, I did my own thing, you know, and I was never going to be one of those really cool kids that are like really cool and kind of, I just did my own thing. I just thought, oh, fuck it. And I think I had a bit of that from a young age. So I'm kind of proud of that now. But, you know, being the black, you know, the black sheep of the family, is a, there's a bit of hype involved.
Yeah, yeah.
The, you will know this. You've
become very well known for your portraits of Indigenous folk from, you know, from all around the world. When did that theme start entering your artwork?
Well, like I said, when I was a kid, I was quite fascinated. I was collecting, doing a lot of drawings from books, a lot of European medieval kind of battle gear or ceremonial gear, a lot of Native American imagery. I would draw a lot of Native American kind of shields and anything, really. And then it fits in with what was going on musically with, you know, Bow Wow Wow and Adam and the Ants. There was that whole cultural appropriation in a way coming in, but hey, I was 10, you know, like, I was lapping it up. So there was always, I loved all that reference to that organic kind of very tribal approach to fashion, which comes back to the punk look as well, you know, and the way I look. So it was always there, that appreciation of that, you know, kind of a more primitive organic approach to costume and dress. So, yeah, it's been there all along. I know it's really pretentious when people say, I've had the idea for 40 years now. And
you just say, fuck off.
Yeah, but, you know, it has always been there with me. It's with the music as well. You know, I liked a lot of that kind of imagery with music. So it is something that's always been there. But I first really started painting myself. I was kind of daubing myself with face paint. And I'd take photographs and things and... and then I was doing paintings from that, so initially, but then it morphed more back into some of the imagery and the ideas I had when I was younger. And I just feel it all goes hand in hand there. You know, it's the world is such a small place. You know, the tattooing, because you remember as well, there was a time where there was only certain small groups of people that had tattoos.
Yeah,
it might have been criminals or punks or bikers. As well, now it's weird seeing like posh middle class kids with like sailor tattoos.
Yeah.
You know, my dad ran away and went, you know, probably impregnated a few girls as well, and lived on the fair when he was 17, came back with loads of like cliched kind of, do you know what I mean? Sailor tattoos.
Yeah. The dagger through the skull.
It's weird for us to see people with these tattoos on their necks and things. And so, but it's interesting at the same time how all that body modification has all, whatever you want to call it, it's all gone round and round now, hasn't it? So it's kind of nice to see in a way, but it does make me feel a bit old as well when I see, I used to get beaten up for looking like that, but so it's a double-edged sword in a way.
When was it you started taking your portraits from the canvas onto a brick wall?
Well, I was doing paste-ups probably about six, 7 years ago, actually. Yeah. I keep thinking it's 2020. In my head, it's about 2017. But before that, I was doing a lot of woodcuts and things. You know, I was doing, like, woodcut prints. So I was doing them on the streets. But, and I, you know, as you know yourself, you know, we kind of, that whole tagging term didn't really exist, you know.
Yeah.
Back in the day, it wasn't a term that was used. But so, you know, I stopped the scribbling on, you know, writing my name on bus stops a long time ago. But I have always been somebody who's kind of kept my finger in, and I've never really been able to walk past wet concrete without kind of...
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's just that even now, you know, I still do it. It's just in me. But in terms, to answer your question, I mean... probably about, 6, 7 years ago, but I was doing, you know, my woodcut stuff. But as the scene was emerging, everything was getting bigger and walls were getting bigger, and I was seeing pictures of, like, you know, 20-story kind of skyscrapers.
Yeah, yeah.
So my little woodcut prints were getting blown out of the water, because it's funny, I would get, like, MDF from, like, home base. And, you know, I'd be doing, for woodcut prints, they were quite big, you know, 3 meters by 2 meters. That's a lot of cutting in wood. Yeah. So I'd go to the print studio in Hackney, and there'd be some Japanese lass that come up. she'd have a little line up. And I'd literally carry these big boards on my head. They'd think I were fucking mad. Because to them it was, you know, if you were on the street, I'd seen you were very aware of people like Swoon and from America. And that was really exciting. And El Porto and a lot of those people that were mixing up different, you know, woodcut, liner cut printing. So, yeah, it was bizarre going to the studio carrying my MDF sheets that I spent a month carving. So originally it was that, but then the murals got bigger and bigger and I realised I needed to turn my mic up and turn my amp up. So it was just translating a lot of the painting skills that I do in the studio to the wall. It took me a bit of adjusting, really, to do the more kind of final approach. Yeah. But
I remember when I first saw one of yours, I can't remember which one it was, but it was probably about maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It was literally one of those where you walk around the street and then all of a sudden it's you're next to it and you're like, hell.
That's what I love. Yeah. I love that idea that, because I love it when it happens to me.
Yeah.
Because as you get older, you know, you kind of become, be honest, you get a bit jaded and you kind of, yeah.
You just see but I like steps it that people just
trotting down to buy some whatever, you know, some makeup from Harrods as we do. And then you're just like, what the fuck? You
know? Exactly.
And I kind of like that culture clash in a way, that those big eyes and the kind of dramatic face paint.
Yeah,
and a lot of people write to me on things and say this.
It made me sort of cross over the road as well, you know, because you can't see anything next to you, can you? Like, you know, free.
Yeah, no. Eyes are kind of, you know, that big.
Well, that's
yeah,
the thing.
I quite like that.
That's the thing that draws you in, is that the eyes, they are just looking straight at you, and it's you who has to avert your gaze. You know.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, my last one I painted, it was one of the first ones I'd done where the eyes were looking away, and it doesn't really have the impact that those that we're talking. It's a shame, really. But people do, those eyes do kind of stop you in your tracks. It's a shame, really. I tried something different, but it does dilute the power of them.
Well, I think it's exactly that, what you just said. There is a power struggle between the viewer and one of your artworks, and your artworks will always win because they're not looking away. You know, it is that struggle that you're always going to lose.
It's true.
And we're the ones who walk away, you know.
Who's going to blink first? You or the mural?
And I did nick a little bit of text off of your site, and it does say that, if I can read it out quite badly, Darryl's work is boldly figurative and is inspired by his strongly held humanitarian beliefs. However, this political message is always achieved by an emphasis on power, direct emotions, and deep empathy for his subject. And that I'm not sure I've seen anything as accurate in an artist's statement before.
I didn't write that. I stole that off somebody else.
But whoever's...
No, I think it's good. I'm better in written form, in real life form.
I'm with you
there. I'm kind of, you need to get the editing thing out and edit me out. But yeah, I think it's right. And that's what I tried to achieve. But it was funny at my opening the other day, I had an opening for my show and thing. Hang on. Just cat alert here. There is a cat on the scene. So
they do like to join in, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I love it that they do, because the Burmese, she's a Burmese girl, and they're always, if there's a camera of any kind, they think they're kind of like the Naomi Campbell of the feline world. She'll be involved. Hopefully she doesn't jump at the camera, but she looks really glamorous and sophisticated, but she does act a bit like a crackhead coy thief at times and goes a bit crazy, so bear with me. But yeah, it was funny at my opening, because, you know, I like that thing where sometimes I use the, like, eyes, because I collage the faces together, but I like using you know, the pupils and the retina where you can see the photographer sometimes in the reflection. But obviously, if you're the viewer, the you know, it's actually you. And one of the paintings, I put three people in. And somebody said to me, like, what the fuck's going on? It's really freaked me out. And I said to them, you know, you're in the middle, but the two on either side are the spirits of your relatives that have passed over, but you can't see them, but the viewer can. And they were like, no, it's funny because I've been watching videos about clairvoyance and psychic mediums, and they're always talking about, you know, oh, you've got your grandma with you. So when I was talking about this, I said, you know, it's just the people from the spirit world just, to come to scare the hell out of you. You can't see them. But it, jokes aside, it is, you know, I love the idea that it's a bit like when you see the Mona Lisa as well. I don't know if you've seen it at the Louvre. And the eyes really do follow you around, you know, and I kind of like that idea that they lock into you. And like you said, you've got to be the first to back down in a way. Because I think it can be easy. I'm not saying all of them, but I think it can be easy to be a bit sentimental as well and a bit with, you know, like hungry black child cliche. And I don't really want that. I want, as I've said before, I want the murals. Not all, I don't capture it of all of them, but, you know, I like that defiance and the cat shoes and the spider pants. She looks like she's doing the bot, you know, on the...
Well, I like the idea that normally it is the white man invading their territory.
Yes, whereas yes, exactly.
This time, it is definitely the other way around. Yeah, they are intimidating us.
I've never really liked that bit of spin. No, it's quite an interesting take on it. I mean, I've been very aware of kind of like that extraction in a way where you take a person or people imagery and then put it out of context. But you're right, that's the whole point. We've done a lot of fucking up, haven't we, you know, in the world, and we've caused a lot of problems with Homo sapiens and with animals. We've messed up the balance of things, and by going over and, oh, I've got a cat being very unladylike here. Yeah. Do you mind? That's a bit weird. She's jumped really high onto, because I've got these big glass. Yeah. She may land on my head. Just ring the ambulance. If I go off screen and ring the ambulance.
I'm saying that.
But about... you're right. I like that idea that, you know, they're quite dominant. And
saying that about taking people out of their environment and putting them into ours.
Yeah.
The other week I was doing one of these with a guy called Lal Owerko. He's the guy who captured the explosion in one of the Twin Towers, the famous photograph.
Oh, yes. So
he's the one who caught that. And he was saying he'd done a project just before the Twin Towers happened.
Yeah.
But he was doing something with this tribe in Africa. And because that, they got brought into New York. And they brought three of these tribesmen over in their... you know, in their full garb. And he said it was funny that they were staying with him in his New York apartment. And he's like, you know, he's like, I've only got this small bed, you know, spare bedroom. They've pushed all the beds apart and they were sleeping on the floor because they couldn't do the mattress thing, you know.
No, they freed them out, yeah.
Yeah, he said, escalators, that done their mind.
No, they freed them out, yeah.
He said, but when they saw people on travelators, like, why aren't they just walking? How lazy do you have to be? He said, but the thing that made them laugh the most was, he said, we was like walking through New York. I don't know whereabouts it was in New York. He said, but they saw a big guy walking along with like a Chihuahua or a, you know, a Yorkshire Terrier. He said, they saw this big guy walking along with this little dog. He said, and just all three of them just burst out laughing at him, pointing at this guy, you know. Funny.
But I love these. Stories where, you know, people do have very different experiences, and we're quite disconnected from our, you know, kind of our with nature, really. I just feel that's one of the problems as well. We just seem so kind of disconnected. I find it quite worrying.
Yeah,
I've been doing a lot of greenery in the paintings, and if I could spin the camera, there's There's green everywhere. There's a massive plant over there, just whatever it is, 15, I don't know. You know, I kind of like it. I like being, because I just feel, especially in London, it's quite easily to be kind of...
Whoa. Well, there's your cat.
I heard it. Yeah. What was I saying? I thought she was going to hit me. I wouldn't be doing any more supermodeling with Naomi. Where were we anyway? That was a total distraction.
How do you relax, Dale?
Oh, that's a good question. If you ask my psychotherapist, she would say I'm never relaxed. Relaxing's a good word. I don't know. I'm quite a home bird. I like being at home, and I love onesies, you know, because I used to wear a lot of, what did I call them? The boiler suits. I used to really like boiler suits and stuff, and with my boots and things. So it's nice. I like getting in my onesie. I've got like a granny blanket as well. And I just love being on the sofa in my onesie and my granny blanket. See, there's a lot to be said for being older, you know. You end up doing all the things you don't want to do when you're 14, you know, like steal cars and glue sniff. Now I like hanging out in my electric blue onesie under my blanket. But it's over. Sorry, I'm just on cat alert. She's working up to another attack, I think. But but relaxing is an interesting one, yeah, because I've been having this psychotherapy. I know as Brits aren't supposed to talk about this, but it's one of the problems, really, that we're not fucking talking about. You know, kind of our mental health or anxiety and things. So she would probably argue that I'm the kind of person I'm never really relaxed, and I would probably agree with it because it's made sense of late. I'm one of those people I really have trouble sleeping. I have trouble sleeping, and the way she described it was really interesting. They call it emotion regulate. So when I wake up, Maisie, stop it, please. So I wake up, and she's really explained it and made me feel normal because I kind of wake up in a very heightened state, and they call it emotion regulate, where you really like, it's almost like you're on speed. I did it last night. I was up at 4:10, and I'm just like, zzz. So you're on, because of my childhood and things, it puts you on a different level.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting word, the I word. So to answer your question, finally, you thought I'd forgot, but I've been doing a little bit of like hypnotherapy, listening to hypnotherapy tapes. I actually had hypnotherapy for sleep, and I actually find that's good as well. Because it really makes you aware of kind of relaxing your muscles. And sometimes I drift off and, yeah, it's nice. It's nice. I've been tuning into a lot of YouTube stuff in my onesie and just like tuning down. I have a lot of creative energy as well, and that doesn't help. Yeah. Like you, you're probably the kind of person who's thinking about, oh, I must interview this person, I must do that, and sometimes it can be good, but if you're the kind of person like me where you're already in a like, it only magnifies some of that nervous energy. So I kind of, bring out the electric blue onesie. That's what I say.
Well, there's different levels of relaxation, and there's just like there's different levels of awareness. Like I'm always, you know, my mind is always going. So my way of relaxing, I mean, I could never.
What do you do?
I, there's loads of different things I could do that I do, not necessarily to relax, but to stop me being so active, because I couldn't lay next to a swimming pool in Spain or lay on the beach. That'd do my fucking head.
Could you not do that?
I have to be doing something all of the time. But again, to relax, it'd be, you know, like what you've just said, I might put on some music, a bit of Pink Floyd or, you know, something like that. To take you out of your situation.
The wormhole. You go on to look at a Sex Pistols video, and then you end up watching a documentary about Mongolian mating habits before, and you're like, how did I get here? But you're right. It's quite, it actually distracts you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The YouTube wormholes can really distract you from what's going on. And you think, what time is it? So, I'm kind of similar, but I can, when I'm on holiday, I do get into reading and it's one of the times where I sleep a bit better as well, I think, and I kind of switch off. So, but it can be hard, can't it, to just really, because we've got our phones with us and it's all linked in with work.
That's the thing, isn't it? The fucking phone. Get rid of that for,
I know.
Put it aside for a few hours and you really
throw it into that swimming pool. That's what I say.
But we need it.
You know, talking about phones, like we're saying about losing, when I was saying about, I haven't really explained it well, but when we're talking about getting out of touch with our more natural rhythms and things, I do worry with kids because I was, and you've probably seen me, you know, from a background, well, we made a lot of things because we didn't have money.
Definitely.
And there was a lot of, when you asked about creativity, I even forget about that because it's such a fundamental part of our childhood, making go-karts and, you know, kind of just making all sorts of bizarre things. And it really is one of the things, it's not so much directly with nature, but it's one of the things that I think upsets me with the idea of young people or children or teenagers, that they've lost that kind of tactile thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, things could be a bit hands, whether it was making a guy, forgot, you know, Guy Fawkes and things. I think they're so enjoyable, but I probably sound like a real old bastard.
Well, no, it's the phones for the kids is the easy way to stop boredom. But the trouble with that is when they haven't got their phone, they don't know what else to do. Yeah. And when lockdown hit, I didn't want my kids being in their room, you know, like, doing a prison sentence, you know, sort of like
20 hours
in their room. So we ended up like reconfiguring our back garden with a path going down the middle. We'd always wanted to move the path to the side. So we said, right, perfect. The world has come to a standstill. And all of us, you know, while me other half was at home, she was working from home. So me and the kids went out there, pulled up all these fucking paving bricks and over the course of a week or so, moved the path. And the first couple of hours, it was torture for them.
It was hell on earth.
But at the end of it, they are so proud. Even when they go out in the garden, they've got a smile on their face because it's an achievement. They can see what they've achieved rather than just using their fucking thumbs, you know?
Yeah. It sounds like a good project. It's part of the home. It involves them, you know, they get some benefit from it. Yeah, it's. I just wish there was. I don't know because I haven't got kids. But I do see, you know, the kids I see around. I do. It does worry me. But then again, adults as well. You know, I've been threatening at the dinner table. You know, I've been threatening to put a sign up in a very unsubtle way. Keep your fucking phone away from the dinner table because it really bugs me, especially when people come to stay and you have some wine and you chat. It comes back to that sitting around the campfire. You know, you would sit around and whatever, drink, you know, mead or whatever and tell stories. And I think that whatever, you know, they might sing, but in our case, you know, that related stories and memories and ideas and chatting. But it's such a shame that's eroded a little bit, you know, with the phones.
So as a family, we refuse to have phones at the dinner table.
You do that good.
Yeah. While there's plates on the table, the phones aren't there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good thing. Yeah. Because it's funny. You just reminded me, really. I'm talking about real obvious working class things. But my mum, when we were a kid, really was opposed to us. We'd have to sit at the table and she was really opposed to us having the TV on. And I've never really thought about that. You've just reminded me of something. Where I guess the general kind of ethos was that almost like French approach to like middle class French life, where you drink wine and over kids with elder family and you converse and you have a nice time. So I think there was a little bit of that in play there. People, you know, mum was trying to have us all together at the meal table and focus on being a family. But it's quite sad, you know, that is going. But I don't know. I mean, without coming across as a real fascist dictator, I mean, what do you do about it? But like I said, I don't mind if people say, like, if somebody's got a family member who's ill in hospital and they just say, look, I've got to check my phone. And I don't really mind. But when people start playing on fucking Facebook when you're serving a meal, somebody spent like 4 hours. But it does make me wonder with young people, because I haven't got kids. I don't know. I mean, it makes me wonder how much it's changed conversation. I'm not talking about being, you know, I'm not saying 12-year-olds are on Tinder. What I meant is the old, the 18. How they're meeting people and girlfriends and boyfriends, but it does make me wonder how it's really affected our conversation kind of skills in a way. It's a bit worrying.
But it's probably going to be no different from the generation above us who were, you know, moaning about the way that we done it, and then we're moaning about them. No doubt they're going to be moaning.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're going to say, "Oh, when I was a kid, all I had to play with was me Xbox and me phone."
I only had one phone at the real table.
You're lucky you've got it impregnated into your head.
You've got it all built into your skull. You don't know you're born. Yeah, it's true, but it's quite easy to. It's funny actually talking about Donald Trump and those kind of people. It's funny when, because being into punk, I loved all the kind of Sex Pistols stuff. But it's funny when you see people like John Lydon and people of that age group, and they don't realise they've totally fallen into the trap. They whinge on and they become really reactionary and moaning about how it's not proper music. But they just can't. They have no perspective on what they're saying.
They've become the person they moaned about.
Yeah, they just can't see that they've turned into everything that they said they weren't going to be, and it probably fits in with...
When he'd done a butter advert.
Oh, the butter thing,
What the fuck?
I mean, it's weird in a way. I mean, I didn't get as freaked out because he was hardly kind of like off-the-grid vegan anarchist. He wasn't like crass or anything, but I think a lot more people were freaked out. I mean... It was funny yesterday in the studio. I was listening to Public Image Limited live at Brixton Academy. It was like a really long set. It's on Spotify. And in between one of the songs, he said, "Oh, and next year's tour will be sponsored by either Alpen or something." Because what I've read is that, you know, he'd really used the money to get Public Image back on the road and that. And I don't really mind that in a way. It was a bit like when bands like Chumbawamba in the 80s, and then they did the whole, "I get knocked down, I get up again." And it just went massive. It was like number two in America. You know, one minute you're seeing them with loads of punks, you know, in some village hall in Preston. Yeah. And the next minute they're on Top of the Pops. But it was similar to them. They said, "Well, we took loads of money, but we gave it to an anarchist group in Italy." And in a way, I kind of like that practical side. But I know what you mean. It is kind of...
But even him doing the anchor advert is kind of punk anyway, because it's going against what people expect of him.
Well, exactly, yeah.
It's like anti-punk, isn't it?
Yeah, where it all goes full circle. So I didn't get too upset by it. But, you know, sometimes it's like me. People have asked me about... you know, more corporate things, but I try not to get involved with some of the nasty companies because I don't, but I it has happened, and I've took the money and I've ran, kind of thing. You have to do it sometimes. It's not a perfect world, and you have
funny,
to...
Bell, but pride don't put bread and butter on the table, does it? You know?
Exactly. So sometimes you've just got to balance things out a little bit, and haven't you, Maisie? Maisie knows. She's an anarchist. Look at that tail. I'm going to dye it pink when I get off.
if there was you and five other artists, like past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Oh, I'd probably have somebody like Constable O'Turner. I'd have a really kind of established traditional landscape painter. I really liked a painter who really inspired me to put around, you know, before my mum died. Don't do that, sweetheart. She's going to climb up the tripod. It's going to happen. Yeah, probably there's a painter called Peter Howson.
From Glasgow. He wrote to me when I was in jail.
Oh, did he? Brilliant. Because
lots of troubles himself.
Yes, exactly. You know, you can... good. No, I'm giving you a high five there. So Peter, I mean, again, when I was transitioning from being an up-and-coming graphic designer of bus timetables or something, I saw Peter's work, and he really, really inspired me and some of the ideas and that. So I think Peter would be in it because he really helped me get back on track with my painting. And I've actually got two. I've got one that Peter gave me, and I've got another one over there. that I bought when I was in Glasgow. And I just stumbled across a shop, a mate of his, sold smaller pastels for charity, for homeless charities. So I bought one when I was up there. But then I did a portrait of Peter as well, which he saw. Nice. And we did like a swap. So it made really, yeah, they're like pride and joy. I sometimes pinch myself when I look at my Peter Housen because I think, you know, because he was such an inspiration. So Peter would have to go in. Who else would go? I mean, somebody probably, yeah, I really like Lucian Freud. I think Lucian Freud would go in, those big unapologetic slabs of flesh. And he would have to go in. Where are we up to? Number three. I don't know who else would go in. I like an artist, Adrian Gini, a current guy from the last, do you know his work? No. I think he's from, where's, is he from Hungary? I think, do you know Adrian Gini's work? No. Yeah, he's
take a look.
Eastern European painter. Yeah, I really like his stuff. I don't know. I'm a bit old. I'm a bit like music. I've started to realise people ask me who my favourite painters are, and I feel like I'm stuck in a bit of a...
That's never a bad place to be.
Yeah. It's nice when you can move forward, though, as well. I mean, I tend to like pieces by individual artists, you know, because a lot of it with me is stuff that inspires you by. Yeah. Hopefully I do a piece that inspires me to paint, but, you know, sometimes it comes from an individual piece by one artist. And, you know, because I love that lineage of Freud and Jenny Savile and Francis Bacon. I kind of love some of that. But when I was younger, I liked a lot of German expressionist stuff, and there were people like Jörg Immendorf, and there was all kinds of a mix of contemporary German people and Peter Housen. There was another painter as well, Ken Curry, do you remember?
Have
you
heard of Ken Scottish Curry? As well. Very dark, ghostly.
Yeah, yeah.
And quite scary.
Yeah, they were, and they got even, because when I saw him in Glasgow at, is it the Glasgow, I can't remember the name of the venue, but they got this circular piece, you know, this mural, but it's kind of got darker and darker, but he's an artist that's been overlooked a little bit, hasn't he? But, you know, a lot of those European painters, let's have 15 of them.
Exactly, you can't narrow it down.
We could double hang them just to get everybody in.
Well, when I sort of fell in love with art and thought I'd like to be an artist, I did think to myself, no one like me is an artist. Yeah. It's only posh, white, middle-class people, you know.
Yeah.
And then I saw an artist called Ray Richardson.
Oh, I love Ray's work. Same again, high five. Yeah, Ray's. Exactly. Yeah.
I saw Ray on a program, and this was at the very, very early days when I just fell in love with art. I saw his artwork first on this program, and then he started talking, and he spoke like me.
Yeah.
And I was fucking hell, he's on telly. Yeah. You know, it can work.
Yeah, good. See, that's what I love. The stories like that where it breaks all those silly kind of flowery boundaries a little bit. But yeah, Ray's work was really good. I mean,
I met him, very similar.
Shows probably in the early 90s, yeah. And,
they're very similar, him and Peter, because they're quite grotesque figures. The hands are large hands and gnarly.
Yeah, it was like caricature, wasn't it?
Those, very much so.
You know, and I love that. I love that kind of over the top kind of, it's like quite theatrical as well. But Ray's stuff was really good. I haven't seen his recent stuff, but I've still actually got quite a lot of his early catalogues.
Can you see that little one?
I can see it. Yeah, go and get it. Let's have a look.
Hold on, just one second.
Let's have a look at Ray's piece.
And this was like a little study he done.
Brilliant.
Just beforehand. Pride of place, but definitely.
Yeah. If I'd have known we were going to be pulling pictures, I'd have ran over and got my Housens. We could have got really competitive, started waving pictures.
Well, Peter Housens, fucking
my Housens bigger than yours. Yeah, but Ray's work, I still love. There was a guy who used to own Atlantis. He still does, more. I've known him on and off from going in the store, but I've worked a little bit with the store. And he bought quite a lot of Ray's early stuff, and he's got some really lovely, beautiful, big, juicy canvases.
He doesn't show them anymore, does he? They used to be hanging up in the on the walls, didn't they?
Yeah.
But they're not.
He's
there
got
anymore,
them in his office. Yeah, he's the last time I saw him, he had him in his office, and we were going around chatting. But there's some lovely pieces. They were amazing. But it was lovely experience because you. When I first saw them, they were on that Brick Lane. It was like part of a Truman Brewery in the early 90s. And they'd have loads of Ray Richardson's and Peter Harrison's. And then there were like free coffee, like what I considered American coffee. I've never had coffee like that. So it seemed really glamorous. You know, you'd go in and buy a small tube of paint. I wasn't shoplifting, by the way. I'd buy a small tube of paint and then it'd be like, American coffee and Peter Harrison and Ray. So it was like you died and gone to heaven. So it was really, just going to the art shop was really inspiring for me because you could see original paintings by some of these guys. And we're on the same track anyway,
If you have a look at contemporary Ray's recent work, you'll see he's got one painting of a big guy in a boat. And it's a rowing boat, but the boat's on land. With Brexit, and he's got like an England top on, you know. That's me.
Is that you? Yeah. Where can I see this?
It'll be on his Instagram page. Yeah. It's on there. I'll send you the pictures.
I love that, though. I love those kind of... Yeah, when you peeped off camera there, it really captured for me because the camera's got that cinematic kind of widespread. It really reminded me of that very kind of cinematic feel that Ray captured. And it really kind of added mystery, didn't it? Because they'd look like movie stills. Yeah. And they'd really make you think, what's going on? Who's on the telephone? And who's the waiter
Exactly. You're more interested in what you're not seeing than what you are.
I need to have a bit of a Ray Richardson, as they say in America, renaissance, you know, a bit of a renaissance and go back. But I've still got quite a lot of the early catalogues and things that I used to follow the shows and things. So I should, But nice work.
What do you reckon you'd like to be, Dale, if you wasn't an artist?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really know, really. I mean, I love animals. I like being around animals. I'd end up strangling them probably. I've had to clean them out kind of every day. It's a really tough question. I can't really answer it. I like the idea that I kind of do some big grand almighty kind of, be part of some grand almighty cause to help people or animals. But I don't know. I'd end up working in Tesco's or something. I don't really know. Whoa, where did you come from? That's the boy cat. I don't really know. It's really hard because it's been part of my life for so long. It's hard to... I mean, the only thing I was really interested in was the music, and I did music and stuff. And in the early days, more punky stuff, and then I was... the more electronic stuff. So I was writing some drum and bass and doing the electric stuff and was involved in that. So maybe if it wasn't the painting, it would maybe be something a bit more creative. Yeah. I think it'd have to involve being creative like you. You have to satisfy that creative urge that's going on, in your head. So. But yeah, to do something normal, I think, would be quite scary for me. And
how can people see your work, Dale, from website or Instagram, social media?
If they send me the credit card details and the expiry date, I send them a nice painting. I don't know. I've got my website. I'm on Instagram, Dale_Grimshaw. I've got the website, dalegrimshaw.com, which isn't terribly up to date, but if you just want to get an idea of what I'm up to, what I've been up to, that's a good way. But mainly, Instagram and my website. I don't kind of get too involved in Twitter and things like that. There's only so many websites I can visit and kind of update. I get a bit fed up with it all, to be honest. I'm a painter. I just want to paint, really. At the end of the day, but you can see the work there. So And I've got a show on at the minute as well, which I forgot about, Assembly of the Gods, which is on Well Hung Gallery in Hoxton. It's on for the next 2 weeks. So it's closed. I think the gallery's closed Sunday and Mondays, but it's open Tuesday to Saturday. So it's Well Hung Gallery. And so, yeah, there's a pretty amazing show on there, and I don't mind saying so myself. So get your little self along. Actually, I'm going to be there. Funny enough, I'm going to be... there's a few people coming down. I'm going to give a little talk. There's only about 8 people. There might be some more, but around about 8. So on Tuesday afternoon, I'm going to be down and at about 1:15. So I'll probably talk about the work and... yeah, it's a college group. It's the, I think, is it the Mornington Crescent Working Men's College? Oh, you know about one of the more, it's a really old college and they still do a lot of like, adult courses like wood cutting and things we were talking about. So it's, I did a bit of a talk there a couple of years ago. So it's some of the people from the adult course who are kind of trotting along. So and I really like that idea. So it'd be nice. So I'm going to... I'm going to peel out of my electric blue onesie and I'm going to get myself down there and tell them what's what.
I'm quite sure this won't be out while the show's still on.
Yeah.
I've already got a few lined up, you know.
No worries about it, yeah. But get down. I mean, get down and have a look at the show. Yeah, it's good.
I'll definitely go and have a look. I've just written down the dates and times.
Yeah. Like I said, it's closed Sunday and Monday, but yeah. If you tell them you know me, they might give you a free glass of water or something. You know, mate.
Well, that's that's all my questions are. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, mate. You're welcome. Yeah. All right. See you later.
Thank you, mate. Bye-bye.
I don't know how. Leave. I'm going to press the leave button.
Oh, how about that, Mr. Dale Grimshaw? Again, I know I say it often, but another artist that I didn't know, and after a couple of minutes, it felt like I'd known him for years. If you've not seen Dale's portraits, go and spend a little time on Google, or better still, his Instagram page. They're things of absolute beauty. Well, I'm going to leave it nice and short on the outro. Again, I'd like to wish you all a Merry Christmas, and I hope it doesn't sound patronising. But us not being able to mix with other people from outside of our household could have an adverse effect on people over Christmas. And if because of that you're having to spend it on your own and you're feeling a bit poxed off, you can always use social media for what it's intended for, to be social. There's a million people on there at any one time who fancy having a chat, I know. We're back again next week with an artist who's relatively new to the art world. And believe me, before you buy any of her artwork, you're better off reading the small print. That's all I'll say on that matter. But like I mention every week, on whichever platform you're able to listen to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really would help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. So, thanks for listening. Merry Christmas. And until next week, ta-da.